Hello, Earl Green here, webmaster of thelogbook.com. I'm going to talk about the end of the world as we know it. We feel fine. It's the second episode of Doctor Who. I have a theory as to why Sci-Fi Channel chose to put these two episodes together and make a two-hour premiere of the show. Sci-Fi Fridays are basically a lineup of what I refer to as space hardware shows. You have ships, you have scanners, you have weapons, you have large computer animated robots going around trying to kill people or just subjugate their entire civilization. Doctor Who is not a space hardware show. It really isn't. Despite these close-ups of the control panel, Doctor Who is more of a, you know, it's, as I alluded to in the podcast I recorded for the first episode, Rose, it is an adventure show with strong leanings toward emotional character development and elements of horror. And so it's an odd fit for Sci-Fi Friday. So I have a feeling the reason that we have The End of the World airing on the first night is to get a science fiction heavy, special effects heavy, hardware heavy episode on the first night. Because if you think about it, with Rose, we didn't even get out of London in the course of that episode. We didn't even go into space. So here we have something which really does play to the science fiction element. It's worth noting the frankly magnificent TARDIS interior. A lot of the design work was done by comics artist Brian Hitch, and I think he did a fantastic job with it. Again, just in case you didn't listen to the other podcast I recorded for the first episode, how dare you? No, seriously. Just to cover some of the same ground, I am by no means an expert on this show. I am not a published author with 13 books written about it. And there are certainly people who are far more scholarly and engrossed in the mythology of Doctor Who than I, but I'm a fan, I've got time on my hands, I have the ability to do a podcast, and so here I am. I also did not think that, the BBC didn't even podcast the first season of Doctor Who, so I figured it was probably unlikely that Sci-Fi was going to have anything lined up as far as podcast. So I'm here to talk you through mythology and background, which is not vital to the show. I just thought I would provide this for you, just in case you're interested, if you'd like to know where some of it comes from, and, maybe so you can find other episodes you might enjoy. Going into the main titles now, the pre-titles teaser at this point was a rarity for Doctor Who. It had only been done on 3 previous occasions, if I remember correctly, the Five Doctors being one. There was an intro before that. Time and the Ronnie in 1987, where they had to show the Sixth Doctor regenerating into the Seventh before they went into the titles, because the titles only featured the Seventh Doctor, Sylvester McCoy, and Castro Valva in 1982, which recapped the Fourth Doctor's regeneration into the Fifth. You may also want to, you can also include the 1996 TV movie in the pre-titles teaser category. Although it's such a, the whole TV movie was such a non-traditional structure, I'm hesitant to include it in that statistic. Again, I don't know how Sci-Fi Channel is going to divide the show up. So when they go to a commercial break, just hit the pause button and shut me up. Assuming you haven't already done that. And one final disclaimer, if you hear something go off behind me that sounds like an air raid siren, Don't worry, it's just a weather alert radio. I'm in the Midwestern U.S. and we're having a particularly stormy week. And I could turn it off, but that would be something like disabling a smoke alarm when there's a child in the next room playing with 10 books of matches and a can of kerosene. You could do it, but should you? Probably not. The special effects in this episode were really on a scale that had not previously been seen in the series. And I have read in various places that the special effects house, The Mill, which previously distinguished itself with its work on the movie Gladiator, the Emil Blue, I've read anywhere from one half to one third to one quarter of the money that was paid to it as a subcontractor by the BBC on this one episode. That's not to say that the rest of the episodes don't have effects or aren't as fancy. In fact, I'm really impressed with how many effects there are in later episodes, but there are just so many of them in this one, which again is why I feel Sci-Fi chose to run this right after the premiere episode. None of the aliens in this episode, none of the characters themselves or their species, have previously been seen in Doctor Who. So I have almost nothing to talk about here. Well, that's not necessarily true. In some ways, this episode is it's very much an homage to a long-standing staple of Doctor Who storytelling, which is basically the classic remake of Agatha Christie's Ten Little Indians. This episode strongly resembles, in some ways, the 1972, I believe it's 1972, I need to call up my own guide and look at it, episode from John Pertwee's era called The Curse of Peladon, which, again, is Ten Little Indians with a sci-fi twist and, you know, lots of alien species that we haven't seen before and some that we have. That's referring to the previous episode. The Curse of Peladon aired between January 29th and February 19th of 1972. Again, none of these creatures have appeared before in Doctor Who. However, the Doctor seems to be fairly well acquainted with all of their races. A lot of the pre-publicity photography for this episode wound up all over the place leading up to the first season. And a lot of it seemed to focus on the Mox of Balhoun looking menacing, when in fact he's anything but. Here we have Cassandra, which obviously this is a CGI effect, and a lot of the episode's effects budget went into giving this character something on the order of, I believe it's a total of 4 to 6 minutes of screen time, which for 45 minutes of show, that's a lot of CGI. But again, going back to Ten Little Indians, that basic story premise has been used many a time in the course of Doctor Who history, and this is just the latest one. Yeah, I'm not complaining in any way about originality or the lack thereof, just pointing out that to some degree this story has been told before with different characters, different motivations, different settings. And without the iPod here, I am a big fan of 80s and new wave music. So I dearly loved this scene, especially this shot of the Doctor just jamming out. I loved that. There are two pop songs in this episode. This one is the better fit because the lyrics are such a good illustration of what is going through Rose's mind at the moment. I'm sure, of course, that's why the song is there. There's another song later on, a bit more modern, a bit more mainstream, perhaps. Not sure if the lyrics are as good a fit, but tonally, it was an interesting choice. In case you hadn't noticed, the Doctor was just scanned, and this episode really starts to get us into what happened to the Time Lords, what has happened to the Doctor, what has happened to Gallifrey. All of these things which were not mentioned in the first episode, and again, you don't really need to know a huge amount about Time Lords and Gallifrey, other than to know that that is the Doctor's race and the Doctor's home planet. We don't revisit Gallifrey several times in the season, you know, with impossibly glitzy overlit sets and everyone in bright red uniforms. That simply doesn't happen. I'm sure nobody wants to hear this, sort of like nobody wanted to hear in the previous episode that despite everyone having a crush on Billie Piper, I've really got more of a thing for her mom. Or the character's mom, I should point out. But for some reason, I've found this young blue lady very attractive. I don't know why. I shall say no more on that subject, because I'm sure you're going, oh God, why did I even need to know that? Another thing I alluded to during the first episode, this story really starts to delve into the mindset of the companion in an unprecedented way. Prior to this, probably the most fleshed out companion character had been Ace during the Seventh Doctor's reign in 1987 through 89. And during that time, a lot of Ace's background and motivations and why she was sort of this borderline violent potential street gang recruit type of kid, you know, why she was that way. And however, a lot of Ace's character development also happened in the books which followed, the series of novels which followed after the original TV series was canceled, none of which is essential to understanding the new series again. However, the fleshing out of the character of Rose here really goes further into that, because a lot of the Doctor's companions in the past have been exiles or orphans or people he's rescued for someplace or people who didn't have any place to go. I mean, as much as we all love him, if Jamie hadn't gotten into the TARDIS, he would probably be face down in a field in Scotland somewhere, and, you know, none of his wonderful adventures ever would have happened. Hey, you know, not a nice thing to think about, but his odds of survival weren't good if he didn't travel with the Doctor. And there have been other cases like that, where basically, you know, the ticket aboard the TARDIS is a charity case. Rose is not such an instance. The opening of the first episode really took great pains to demonstrate to us that she has a fairly normal life. She has a job. She has a boyfriend. She has a family. And so I thought it was a really good idea to examine here why exactly she is traveling with the Doctor. Excuse me. So it's good to flesh that stuff out. It comes into play even more, actually, a couple of episodes from now. So just keep that in the back of your mind, if you like. But I think that the way that they dealt with Rose coming to terms with her TARDIS travels was very effective, because so many of the Doctor's past companions have walked into alien settings and said, oh wow, this is amazing. And that's really all you hear of it. You don't get to hear any of their thought process as they, you know, try to accept mentally and emotionally the things that they see during their travels. And again, this show is really written for an audience that has seen things like Buffy, and an audience that has come to expect the fleshing out of characters and their motivations and various subtexts. The portrayal of the Doctor here is very, very consistent with what has gone before. That he is a citizen of the universe. He accepts everything, and he accepts that everything out there, even if it's some kind of parasite, has a right to exist. There are a few times over the course of the original series where this was, that basic tenet of the character seemed to be set aside for the purposes of telling a single story. I would say the third portion of Trial of a Time Lord would be a notable example. But that's, it's very consistent with what has gone before. The great thing about the show, you do not have to have seen a single episode of the original. And I've said this before, I know. You don't have to have seen the original to understand it. If you have seen the original, there is so much for you here. It is a continuation. There was a lot of discussion whenever the new series was first announced in 2003. Which I still remember the day, the evening, when a friend of mine instant messaged me and sent me a link that Doctor Who was going to be back on television. I was stunned. I was completely blown away, because it was the last thing I was expecting. But a lot of the debate that followed after that announcement was, is this going to be a continuation of the original series, or is it going to be a complete reboot of the mythology that completely ignores the original series? At the risk of inflaming some people's opinions, there are good cases for both. There's a good case for a reboot, because we're talking about a show that has offered three different explanations for the destruction of Atlantis, and at least two different explanations for the Loch Ness Monster. It has killed off the entire Dalek race at least two or three different times, each time pointing out that this is the final end, and then they keep coming back for another final end. And we're talking about 26 years, if you're just talking televised stories, 26 years of mythology that holds together remarkably well with a very few exceptions, and all of that planning has been haphazard. We're not talking about a Joe Straczynski thing where it was all hammered out in advance. And so I can see a case for jettisoning that mythology, but I also I really do enjoy the fact that that is not the case here. Russell T. Davies has made it very clear that this is the Ninth Doctor. This is the same Doctor who we have seen in previous adventures, and the mythology is all connected. And it works out very well. Time to call pest control, dude. There's something about the control panel on this guy's desk that it's very Blake 7. don't get me wrong, I love Blake 7. Even more than Doctor Who, Blake 7 is my all-time favorite British science fiction series. But just this very pedestrian-looking keypad on an ordinary desk, there's something very Blake 7 about that. Especially when they don't work. And now he's Cajun. Okay. I really wish Jabe had been brought aboard as a companion. I know there is a conscious effort to make this series decidedly more working class than previous Doctor Who adventures, because let's admit it, the original series was born of a time when upper-class sitting-room drama was the norm on British television. And only with time has it been brought down a notch to where the Doctor is not running around in a velvet smoking jacket with a frilly shirt and, you know, other impossibly, obviously designed wardrobe. However, that said, while Jabe is, obviously an upper crust character as she is, accompanying some sort of delegation to this soiree, and, obviously she has some sort of position or standing in her society in order to be there, there is something about her compassion and her worldliness that is appealing, and it would have been interesting to see her tag along, even if only for a couple of episodes. I would have to look up the actress's name. She was also in Red Dwarf. For those of you who also watch that show, she was in, let me see here. I'm sorry I'm having to look this up. She was in the third episode of the final season of Red Dwarf. She is the air traffic controller who is suitably impressed whenever the cat wanders into Red Dwarf's cargo bay and proceeds to have a dance-off with all of the ship's walking shuttlecraft. I'm sure she's been in other stuff before. I don't have IMDb open in a window. Mouse sound there. Sorry. I'm doing a lot of alt-tabbing here because it sounds silly. I'm checking up on the weather while I'm doing this. I love the line about the bitchy trampoline. That's a bit of language for this show, but times change. It reminds me of in the 80s, I used to watch, going back to Blake 7 a bit, I used to watch Blake 7 on Oklahoma Public Television, which, living on the border of Arkansas and Oklahoma, we have both Arkansas and Oklahoma PBS on our cable system. I remember watching an episode of Blake 7 where one character referred to another as a bitch, And the first time I saw that episode on OETA, I distinctly remember they rewound it on the air back to that point, replayed it, and then dipped the audio at the word bitch as if this is going to make it all right and negate the first time that it was heard. So there's something to be said for conscientious board ops in a television operation, but that was a bit strange. Again, we're getting into here that the Doctor is the last of his kind. If I have really one fault with sci-fi's promotional campaign for Doctor Who, it is that they blew that secret. Now, of course, you know, I say that, but this is the internet age. Everyone has probably, you know, downloaded these already, or they've done what I've done and bought the Canadian DVD set. And so the risk of running the show a year late is that all of the spoilers have been spoiled already, and so there's really no danger. But that said, again, talking about the casual audience that doesn't go in for downloading huge files of TV shows or ordering DVD sets from across the border or across the ocean, that was a surprise that perhaps could have been preserved. So we have just learned that there are no more Time Lords. Supposedly, I'll believe that as I continue to see no more Time Lords. It's actually a rather... given the history of special effects in Doctor Who, that's rather an impressive shot. Sometimes I'm a little confused as to why the Doctor would be so distraught over the destruction of Gallifrey and the Time Lords. I mean, granted, that is his home, those are his people, but he was consistently treated so badly by his own people that one wonders. I found this a little interesting. The Doctor says, "What the hell is that?" That's swearing is not really the Doctor's usual forte, traditionally. John Pertwee was known to say Jehoshaphat sometimes, which I'm not really sure is in the same league as "what the hell is that?" So, again, we get the impression that this incarnation of the Doctor has been through a lot, and some of the niceties of his character and his mannerisms that we've grown used to, you know, have perhaps been eroded away by his ordeal. A little bit of Britney Spears. Actually, like I said, I'm doing this with the DVD. Hopefully there hasn't been some rights issue that gets that song replaced for American TV, or else you're not going to know what in the world I'm talking about. I just thought it was an interesting choice for a song, and while Tainted Love I could imagine hearing, you know, because there's an out-of-time element to it, I never expected to be hearing Britney Spears in Doctor Who. Interestingly, this is not the first time that a current or relatively current song has been heard in Doctor Who. In fact, there's an instance where there has been a song that was in the original broadcast that has not survived to the subsequent video and DVD releases. Going back to John Pertwee's debut episode in 1970's Spearhead from Space, there was a Fleetwood Mac song heard in the background of one scene, which, when it came time to release the Spearhead from Space on VHS and later DVD, that music had to be replaced because the getting rights for a single broadcast is one thing. Getting rights for something which is going to be released and re-released ad nauseum in new media is quite another. And as you can imagine, more money is usually sought for that sort of thing. And this is where we run into things like shows such as Miami Vice and Quantum Leap and so on, and other shows that you hear a big fuss about. The music has been replaced, but sometimes when you're talking about something that sets the tone for a scene, that is a big deal. I'm not sure what you could replace the Britney Spears song with in this instance. There was also a case of some music replacement in the 1985. Let me double check myself before I go saying that as gospel. Yes, March 1985, Revelation of the Daleks included some, I believe it included some Elvis and Jimi Hendrix in the background of a couple of scenes, because a central character in that story was a disc jockey. And once again, those had to be replaced for the VHS and DVD releases. Go home to mama. Nothing subtle about that. Could it be the Men in Black? Sorry, I'm almost misting this more than commenting on it now. Oh, the adherence of the repeated meme. Oh, so those guys are the internet. Okay. Anytime I see people on message boards anymore, that's how I'm going to picture them. Sorry, I don't have much to say here. I really like this episode. This is really one of my favorites of the first season of the new series. And I believe I've read that some of the producers consider this to be among the best episodes as well. It really does feel, to me anyway, like classic Doctor Who with strange aliens, the occasional bits of rubber suit magic, and and this bit of info dump exposition toward the end of the proceedings. And that's something else I liked about Jabe, was you get the impression that she could probably put up a hell of a fight if it came to it. It would have been interesting to see her deal with some of the threats that the Doctor and Rose had to contend with later on in the show. And there is so much to like about this episode. I like the sets and the settings. Some of them are studio sets, some of them are locations. And this, for example, is actually a location. That is not. That's a studio set with a healthy dose of computer imagery. But I just really like the feel of this episode. There are some stories that come along in science fiction that there's so much is revealed about the world that it takes place in by the sets and the setting that it creates its own universe. The original Star Wars is definitely an example of this. I would also hold up The Fifth Element as an example of that, where you can tell so much about the universe from the background details. And And it's just interesting to think about what the rest of that universe is like. This is really one of the very few instances in this season where the character of Rose is brought anywhere even close to the traditional 60s role of the female companion of the Doctor as being someone who screams at the slightest sign of danger. The Mox of Balhoon, though, now he's a little wuss. But he's Cajun now, too. So much for Jabe. I really liked that character. I can't say enough how much I like that character. I'm not really sure. This strange thing where it almost seems like the Doctor is slowing down time enough to just step through harmlessly. That's not really something we've seen before. And I'll be honest, I'm not sure entirely how I feel about that. I also can't remember if the explanation for the destruction of the Earth has been played out differently before. I distinctly remember an episode called Frontios in 1984 where we see a colony of humans that left the Earth before it was destroyed. So I'm trying to remember, and actually come to think of it, in the Trial of a Time Lord, we have seen the Earth moved halfway across the galaxy and given a new name after some great cataclysm. This does not appear to have been a cataclysm that would leave enough of the Earth to move and rename. So, again, this is another one of those things like Atlantis and the Loch Ness Monster, where it's... The fate of the consistency of the whole timeline really rests in the hands of retroactive continuity experts. And I haven't even tried to piece this destruction of the Earth together with the others, the other explanations. Actually, I've dealt with ostrich eggs before. That one was obviously a prop. It's just a little bit thick. And she would have gotten away with it all if it wasn't for that meddling Time Lord. This seems a little bit ruthless for the Doctor here. But again, I'm going to say it's not completely unprecedented. Because the Doctor has before encountered historical situations where bad things were going to happen. You know, the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve. And so on, terrible things are going to happen. Lots of people were going to die, but history has a course to run. Now, it seems like he had a little bit of a hand in, you know, changing Cassandra's destiny there, you know, or was he a part of it all along? That's an open question, but the relative ruthlessness of the character is not completely unknown. And I'll talk more about the, I don't know, shall we say the rudeness of the Ninth Doctor more with the next episode, because it is an element that does come into play. And again, to plug our printed reviews of the entire season of Doctor Who, go to thelogbook.com/TARDIS, go down to the Ninth Doctor episodes. Philip Fry and I did sort of a Siskel and Ebert thing. It came out a little more like CNN's Crossfire, actually, because we had very different viewpoints on the strengths and weaknesses of this season of Doctor Who, and whether or not it really fit in with the rest of the mythology. But there are differing viewpoints there on the Doctor's manners and mannerisms, and so I strongly recommend you read that. This podcast is not meant to replace or supplant or override those reviews in any way. And so, whether you like the show or not, you will probably find that you'll agree with someone in there somewhere. And this is a very, very interesting thing. This sort of goes along with the Seventh Doctor's reign, where he would, it just seemed like he would put Ace through hell just to prove a point to her. And, you know, here we, it seems like the Doctor has done this with Rose in this instance, more or less to ask her, it's a litmus test, you know, are you sure you want to come with me? Are you sure you want to see these things? Because you will see the rise and fall of entire civilizations. You know, you'll see the destructions of entire worlds and entire species if you come with me, because that's the sort of thing I deal with. And again, the last of the Time Lords. Interestingly, that this is not the first time that the destruction of Gallifrey has come up as a plot point. There was one point in the run-up to the 23rd season, also known as Trial of a Time Lord, where many a rumor was spreading that Pip and Jane Baker had written a script where Gallifrey was destroyed, and the story was supposedly going to be called Gallifrey. Well, of course, that never materialized, appropriately enough. But the thing about it is, it's been suggested before, and again, in the late 80s and early 90s, when a Doctor Who movie, which never came about, but the scripts were being developed, again, there was an element of the Doctor being the last of the Time Lords. So, not a completely new thing. So, there we have the end of the world, the end of the first night of the new Doctor Who in the United States. I'm delighted that Sci-Fi has brought the show over. Even if they're a little behind the rest of the world, I enjoy being able to tune in and see it. Please, guys, pick up the second season. You know, if you're not going to show us Galactica new episodes until October, feel free to just go ahead and pick up the second season of Doctor Who and slot it in there. I will be more than happy to watch it. So, that's the end of the world. I will see you again next week in your timeline. And, well, that's interesting. Alien voices provided by Silas Carson. Silas was also Ki Adi Mundi in the Star Wars prequels, wasn't he? I don't remember seeing that credit before. I probably have, but it just skipped my mind. In fact, now I'm sure I'm commented on that in the logbook episode guide. Anyway, that's it for this episode, and we will see you again with the next one, The Unquiet Dead. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.